Brian Terry, and it's my pleasure to have with me today Jonathan Ginsberg. Jonathan, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Brian. Nice to be here.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. It truly is a pleasure. You know, we've watched your work with Social Security Disability for a while, and our audience has a lot of questions, and it's nice of you to spend some time with us to address those. So, and what I want to just let the audience know is that month in and month out for quite some time now, as you have helped people down in the Atlanta area get Social Security disability benefits in a very timely manner, and in a lot of cases without having to use a lawyer, which is like the secret, right? So,
sure, absolutely.
So we're anxious to learn from your perspective all about this topic and how our audience can go through and pursue benefits and get them, you know, without spending a lot of money and get them in a timely manner. So things we're anxious to talk about is starting from the beginning. How do you file? Who qualifies? What do you do to get started? What's the criteria, et cetera, et cetera? So just for everybody that's listening out there and myself, I'd be anxious to learn a little bit more about your background. You're doing some great stuff. How long you've been doing it? Tell us a little bit about your practice.
Well, I've been practicing law here in Atlanta for about 20 years, and about half that time I've been doing Social Security disability, representing claimants, people who are disabled and are trying to get approved for disability benefits. And really, since the time I've been doing Social Security, I've been doing a lot of writing about it, writing on blogs and writing websites and articles and things like that. And it's really a very interesting practice, and it's been kind of interesting to watch how it's evolved over the past 10, 15 years. It's really a lot different than it once was, primarily because the numbers have increased so dramatically. People that are now applying, that the numbers have just really gotten quite large.
Interesting. Just our aging society, perhaps, has something to do with that.
I think it's partially that it's the aging society. I think that there's a lot of medical conditions, and maybe we'll touch on some of this, like fibromyalgia, which is a real big one. We see a lot of that are relatively recent in the sense of being diagnosed more frequently. I think that as medical technologies improve, that the diagnoses become a little bit more standard, and Social Security recognizes some of these things, maybe things that were keeping people from working before. Nobody really knew what the problems were before, but now we kind of know what they are, and Social Security recognizes them. I think there's more information out there in the public, perhaps thanks to the Internet, about Social Security and its various programs, so that people who really can't work know that there's some way they can get some relief and some cash and money to live on with dignity. Because really what I tell people is that Social Security disability is not going to solve all your problems. It will give you some money to live with a little bit of dignity. And to me, that's probably the biggest dividend of this whole process, is people don't have to worry about it. How are they going to pay their rent, or what are they going to eat, because they have a little bit of money coming in from disability.
Takes care of the basics. So in your work and representing those looking for Social Security benefits, where do you do your work? Is it geographically, you know, tied, or all over the place, or?
Well, yeah, it can be all over the place. I mean, most of the time I've been pretty much limited to Georgia because I live here, and it's just easier for me to get to various places. But I've gone from Atlanta to Savannah, which is, you know, 4 or 5 hours away. I've gone to Birmingham. I've gone as far as Buffalo, New York. I do travel sometimes, but I'm pretty busy with the Atlanta cases, so that kind of keeps me busy. One interesting development that's been happening more recently, though, is that the Atlanta office is so far behind and they're so backed up, I mean, literally 2 years from the time the case reaches the office till the time they schedule a hearing, that they've been bringing in judges from all over the country. So I've had an opportunity in the last 6-8 months to try cases before judges out of Virginia and West Virginia and California and Pennsylvania. So even though I'm not necessarily traveling to those places, I am getting a chance to see the judges and how they approach the cases, either differently or not. That's one of the trends in Social Security right now, is they're moving towards video hearings. So a lot of the people that apply, especially if they live in a small state or they live in a place that's not real populated, they may get a hearing done in front of a television with a judge in a remote location, and that presents different challenges, but that's kind of what's going on. So to answer your question, I do most of my physical appearances in Georgia and in the Southeast, although with the onset of video hearings, I suspect that I may be doing more hearings for claimants in various states, but appearing by video.
Wow, technology is certainly getting in the game. It sounds like they're scrambling to keep up.
They are, and, you know, I think that video hearings, there's a place for them, and certainly video hearings are preferable to waiting 2 years to get in front of a live judge. Mm. I would say that a video hearing, you do lose a little bit of the connection that you might otherwise make with the judge. So everything else being equal, an in-person hearing is probably preferable. But as I said, if you've got to wait, a choice of waiting 2 or 3 years to get in front of a judge or getting in front of a judge in 6 or 8 months and doing it by video, the video is probably a good thing to do. I think it's also going to require the judges in the various hearing offices to retrain themselves to not necessarily be so concerned about, you know, their sense of what a claimant is about, because that there's nothing that really can beat that one-to-one relationship. I think what it also does is it makes the attorney's job or the claimant's job, if they're proceeding without an attorney, that much more has to be that much more focused on providing the right medical documentation, the right reports, filling out the forms correctly, because again, you lose that face-to-face with a video hearing that you have to make up in other ways. And again, Social Security is really a lot about speaking the language that Social Security uses, and you've got to know how to do that to win.
Okay, we've got to learn all about that today while we have you here. But speaking of being in front of attorneys, you've obviously had some experience over the years. Any idea how many times you had to go out and represent clients?
I've probably tried over 1,000 cases. You know, I don't necessarily keep track of the actual numbers because I'm busy preparing new cases and working doing various other things, but I'd say easily over 1,000 people I've represented in hearings, and also through my blogs and websites and email and so forth, I certainly talk to a lot of them as well, so I would say that the numbers, people I've talked to, probably close to a couple of thousand, the ones I've actually represented, over 1,000.
And we're going to talk about this a little more later, but I do understand that at some point in your career, I'm not exactly sure where it was, that you got a critical piece of advice from a judge that actually pulled you aside, gave you this piece of information, and since then your success rate has been fantastic.
Absolutely, and I remember it like it was yesterday. I had really been practicing this area only for just a few months, and I was really focused a lot on the medical issues because, again, Social Security, when you look at it on the surface, it's about somebody's medical problems. And the problem, of course, is that Social Security doesn't really focus, even though Social Security is medical-based, the issue in every single case is really about work capacity.
So when you say medical, like how bad somebody's hurt or hurting, or, right?
Right. In other words, here's the best way to look at it. You could have 3 herniated discs, and you could have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and you could have bad liver, you could have all kind of things, bad heart, but if you can still work, you're not disabled. Whereas
Wow.
a person could have a bad, you know, a really painful knee that is, you know, failed surgery on the knee that doesn't, and the knee causes excruciating pain, limitation of motion, that person might be disabled because of the pain. So really, it's not so much the specific diagnosis, that which is important but not critical. The important thing is how this all affects the claimant's capacity to work. And what this judge did, he's since retired, but I ran into him every once in a while, he pulled me aside. He said, you know, I like the way you prepare your cases. You're always prepared. You know your file. He said, but I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. You're focusing on the medical, whereas you really need to focus on your client's capacity for work. And it all kind of clicked at that point. I just sort of looked at him, and I said, you know, I never really thought of it that way, but that's really what this is all about. It's not at all intuitive because, again, you look at the Social Security materials, and you see the pages of listings where they talk about medical diagnoses, but ultimately this is really about functional capacity for work. And if you see it that way, everything that you do with Social Security, every form you fill out, every statement you make to them, needs to be focused on how this impacts your ability to work, because the definition of disability by Social Security standards is, are you able to engage in what is called substantial gainful activity or work? And if you can't, you are disabled. If you can perform substantial activity, then you are not disabled. So you've got to focus on work capacity.
So our natural tendency, or mine, as I think through this process, if unfortunately something was to happen to me like this, is that I'm hurt, I feel bad, I'm not able to work. I would think that that's how most look at it. But the system does not look at it that way. They say, yeah, you're hurt, yeah, you have some pain, but you can still work. So that's what needs to be proved, correct?
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, if you think about it, take it a step further, most lawyers who've done any kind of injury work, if they've done personal injury, car accidents, or they've done workers' comp, they're focused on medical problems because that's really what you got to look at. Social Security is a different animal. It's really about work capacity. And, you know, especially since most cases don't necessarily involve one particular medical problem, they may involve numerous problems. You may have an element of depression, for example, in a lot of cases, in addition to that bad knee or in addition to that, breathing issue or cardiac problem. So it's a combination of things. It's not any one thing in particular. It's maybe four or five things, but you add them together. The lung problems maybe limit the person from performing in hot weather or in a dusty environment. The knee problems might eliminate jobs requiring walking. The depression might eliminate categories of jobs that require interaction with coworkers or supervisors. And so you add all these things together, and the end result is a capacity for work that has been so reduced by these various ailments that this individual would not be able to perform competitive work at any type of job at all that exists in the national economy. And that's the way Social Security looks at it.
Fantastic info. We're going to zero in on that more, but let's start from the top with this for people. And I think what I would like to learn from you is what are the top challenges that are facing people as they go through the process? And I ask that question because for the listener that's brand new thinking about this, of course they want to avoid the mistakes that cause the challenges and the problems, and for those that are in the process and wondering why they've been denied and they're not getting benefits, they want to correct these. So tell us, if you would, Jonathan, what is it? What are the challenges that are out there?
I think there are probably three main things I can point to. The first one, which is a big one, is not being able to get regular medical treatment. Social Security really looks a lot at medical records and a consistent treatment record. And again, ultimately where you're headed with that is you want the doctor to translate those medical problems into very specific work limitations, but you have to have a doctor to support you. And given that this process is now taking sometimes 1.5 to 3 years, claimants have got to have a regular, ongoing source of medical treatment, so they've got a doctor who can comment about their functional capacity. So getting regular treatment is a big, big problem.
I want to pause you right there. I'm sorry. Okay. I just want to pause you right there. Hold your thought. This is great. You said 1 to 3 years. Are you saying it takes 1 to 3 years to complete this process?
It can actually take longer than that. I'm saying that it takes, from the time you apply to the time you actually get your hearing decision, it is not uncommon to be at 3 to 4 years.
Wow. It's really no room for
that. It is really out of control at this point, which is what's leading Social Security to attempt to re-engineer the process. And this is also what's behind all these video hearings, is to try to move things. Again, in Atlanta and in several other states, the actual waiting time from the time you request a hearing, which again may be a year into the process, so you're already at 12 months, it may take another 24 to 28 months to actually get to a hearing. So we may be looking at 3 years before you get to a hearing. Then the judges have to issue the decision, which may take another 6 or 8 months. I've literally, within the last month, tried cases for people who applied in 2001 and 2002, and they're just waiting. And again, it's inexcusable, in my opinion, that people who are, disabled and probably and obviously not able to work, what are they supposed to do? This is a question I get, a lot of attorneys get.
Yeah.
How do I eat? Where do I live? Who's supposed to pay the bills?
Yeah.
And I wish I had an answer for them. It's a terrible, terrible situation. And
okay.
Social Security, to its credit, is trying to address it, but so far not with a lot of success.
Yeah, even if they cut it in half, it's still too long. So let's back up. Medical treatment, that's the first key, right? You need to have consistent...
Correct.
Okay, consistent medical treatment. Okay.
Right.
Let's move on. This is great information. What would the next one be?
And one more comment about that. When I say regular treatment, I don't necessarily mean they have to go every 2 weeks. It can be, once every 3 months, once every 4 months. It just has to be some sort of an ongoing relationship with the doctor so that the doctor can be a treating physician. Social Security, again, classifies everything, and a physician or a doctor who's treated you ongoing is a treating physician, and that doctor's opinion is given more weight than somebody you may see once or twice. So even if you see them once a year or once every 6 months, that can be considered regular treatment. So I tell my clients, you know, you really have got to figure out a way to get to the doctor, and even if it means going to friends and relatives and borrowing the money, it's worth doing that, because Social Security will give a lot more credit to a doctor that you see every 3 or 4 months than one that you've only seen once or twice over that 3 or 4 year period.
So regular could also be termed as consistent treatment, right?
I think that's a good way to put it, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Right. Good tip.
All right, and the second thing you were asking me is, what's the second big issue that's facing people? I think that the delays, and this maybe is part of what we just talked about, but obviously the delays. When you're looking at a 3 to 4 year process, how do you eat? What are you supposed to do during that time? And these delays cause a lot of hardship on people. And again, part of what kind of led me to write my book was, how do you get approved early? So, you know, I'm trying my own way to help deal with the delays, but that is a big problem that Social Security recognizes, that I think anybody who's going through the process recognizes, that these delays are a real, real big problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so consistent treatment would help that out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
The third thing, I think, that is really key to understanding Social Security and trying to avoid these problems is, you got to talk their language. Social Security has its own vocabulary, its own way of approaching things. Again, we touched on this a little bit before about the work capacity focus, but you got to learn to speak their language. Either you or your attorney has to know what they're looking for. Because, again, whether it's a judge or the adjudicator, who's the person at the administrative or the earlier level, they're looking for very specific things. And if you know what they're looking for, you can create a theory of your case. You can create an approach that will give them what they want. And that is crucial. I think a lot of people who go into this process, who do it on their own or who have don't have good representation, they don't know how to speak the language. And, again, even an attorney who's done a lot of work in other areas involving injuries, if that attorney, maybe a great attorney in terms of litigating car accident cases, but may not understand that this is about work capacity, they could completely miss the boat. And certainly somebody who's not represented at all is not going to say, no, this is what they got to focus on, and they may end up wasting a lot of time and effort and not getting to what the judge or the adjudicator wants.
Okay, so
speaking the language is key.
So we need to spend some time learning how to speak the language. Now,
absolutely.
Now, back on the medical treatment side, we get a lot of questions about, you know, my medical records weren't the right medical records. I have problems finding my medical records. So there seems to be some type of maybe there's a tie-in between the medical treatment and the records are part of this equation. Could you speak to that for us?
Well, certainly. I mean, medical, again, you can have medical treatment, but you've got to have those medical records. And what I tell my clients is that they should keep their own file, first of all. So whenever they go to the doctor, they should ask the doctor for copies of whatever they can, you know, MRI reports or X-ray reports. But more than that, they should ask the doctor periodically, if it's every 6 months or once a year, for copies of their file. Because it is not, especially in this day and age, medical practices are bought and sold. Files are, you know, stored or lost, and you know, if someone needs a medical record from a hospital going back 5 or 6 years, it can be very hard to get. In addition, public hospitals are frequently understaffed, and it becomes a real problem to get these records. In Georgia, we have an interesting situation because we can get the records without cost for a disability application. A lot of states don't have that. I know that most places, the actual patient, the claimant, can get the records without a lot of cost. But I think it's important to make a ongoing list. People should do it anyway, really, but make an ongoing list of every place you've been treated at so you can help Social Security by providing a consistent and thorough record. Because, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had cases where we had to amend the onset date, move forward the date when the person, you know, is approved for benefits because we didn't have records that went back far enough.
I've had people complain to us that their records have been lost. So if their records are lost,
yep,
and there's no copy of them, wow, I mean, what an issue.
You're out of luck. And the thing about Social Security, which is kind of nice, is that because it's a fairly informal process, these records don't need to be certified like they would in civil court. So photocopies are fine. As compared to state or federal court, where you've got to introduce them as evidence, they've got to be certified, they've got to be notarized by a medical custodian. Social Security just takes photocopied records. So The best clients I've got are the ones that come in and they've got this big stack of records, and we've got a lot of the work done. We can go ahead and submit those, and Social Security will accept them.
Okay.
So it really comes to the, of course, the claimants are involved in this long before they have an attorney or even before they understand they've got a Social Security case, but anybody who's even thinking that disability might be something in their future, it's very important to, number one, keep a current list of the names, addresses, phone numbers, and fax numbers for the physicians they've seen, but also to keep their own medical file. Because if you don't do it, there's, like you said, there's a good chance, or there's not a good chance, but there's a possibility that file gets lost or misplaced, and you're out of luck.
Wow. So this really needs to be treated like a business. You need to keep your files. You need
absolutely.
To stay on top of them. You need regular appointments from the medical side, and you need to periodically get your files.
Right, and I'll tell you something else, is that Social Security has been known to lose files. So, again, keep copies of everything you send them. I mean, we're at the point now where everything we send Social Security, we spend extra money to send it registered mail, so return receipt requested. Because if you don't and they lose the file, then, you know, you go in limbo for years and years and years. I had a case that I won about 3 or 4 months ago that, I mean, this thing dated back 7 or 8 years. And they lost the file, and we had a copy of it. We sent it to them. They lost that. You know, finally, after 2 hearings and 3 or 4 reconstructions of the file, we finally got it to the judge, and he approved it. I think more because he just felt so bad for the guy who'd been waiting for so long that he approved it. But yeah, they'll lose files. So, and again, I'm not saying this happens all the time, but you got to be very, very alert to that sort of thing. And again, we're going to talk about this, I think, as well. But you've got to make sure you keep track of when you send things in, so you know when things are supposed to come back.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they are dealing with just a flood of paperwork. They're trying to move from a paper system to an electronic system, and things will and do get lost on a regular basis.
Yeah, the stakes are high. It's worth it. Okay, the people that you are working with or coaching or guiding to disability that we talked about briefly in the beginning, that, you know, they're successfully getting benefits without a lawyer and they're getting them in a timely fashion. You have mentioned a book. I call it like a how-to kit, a guide, because it's beyond a book. I've seen it. It's really big and easy to read and all that. Now, this guide that you have prepared, you don't have to tell us everything, but can you give us a sneak preview of what it is and why it's working and successful, and how did you come up with it? I mean, how did all this happen?
I give a lot of the credit to this to my clients, because, you know, doing this day-to-day, I deal with the forms that Social Security has, and it's just sort of a second-nature thing. We fill the forms out, we send them in, and I've had clients, I had one client in particular come to me and say, you know, trying to fill out these forms is real burdensome, because if you are depressed or if you're in a lot of pain, very, very difficult to fill out a bunch of forms, especially these government forms. The forms are, I think I counted over 99 or maybe over 100 at this point, pages of forms. And of course, these are government forms that put together over time, so they keep getting redone, and they're never really completely redone. They just keep adding things to them. So it's kind of like going back to school. And again, imagine yourself being disabled and uncomfortable, and you've got to fill out these forms. There's no instructions really to speak of. There's no real guidance as to what they're looking for, and they're asking all these questions. And a lot of the questions look like they're the same thing, and people are supposed to be filling these things out. A lot of times there's not enough room, for example, in the forms to answer the question, what do you do? So I thought about it, and I said, you know, this really makes sense for me to put something together where people can understand what they've got to do to fill the forms out. They can have a reference where they can look and see how the form should be filled out. I give examples in the book of the forms correctly filled out so that someone can use that. And really the big picture is, instead of looking at a blank piece of paper, you've got something to look at. You can model your answers after the ones I have on there.
Okay. So what I'm hearing, if I get this right, is the forms are out there. That are out there. To help people apply for Social Security disability are really written and targeted towards a lawyer. Is that right?
Well, I don't think it's so much targeted towards a lawyer. It's targeted towards the people who are making the decision at Social Security. Realize that Social Security, again, has their own language. So they're looking for certain things in these forms. So question 7 on a particular form there may be you know, a template that the adjudicator has, and they're looking for certain magic words. Well, you don't know that because nobody's telling you that. I mean, I know it because I deal with it all the time. So really what I'm trying to say is that the forms are out there. They're not at all intuitive or easy to fill out. And what I'm trying to explain to people is this is how you fill them out to speak the language that Social Security's decision makers speak. So that if they ask a question about what you do during the day, you know, your daily, they call them activities of daily living, what they're really asking is, if you were in a work environment, would you be able to perform a basic level of activity? So they don't really care whether you vacuum or make your bed, but what they care is if they see activities that are equivalent in some way to work activity, that will go against you. So you've got to know. And again, perfect example, vacuuming. You know, even though you wouldn't think about it, I've had many situations where I've seen that vacuuming is an activity that for whatever reason Social Security sees as being something that is work-like in scope. Mm-hmm. Just pushing a vacuum has, I guess, certain physical implications that mean that you maybe have certain physical capacities. So, you know, when I'm advising somebody out and they're talking about what they do, they may vacuum once every 6 months, but you wouldn't want to put vacuuming on there as an activity because it's probably something that would hurt you. Whereas making your bed or you know, dusting occasionally is not going to be a very big deal. Kneeling to clean a tub, you know, doesn't sound like a big deal, but it means that you could potentially do work involving kneeling. So all these questions have sort of implications, and what I try to do is explain what those implications are and give examples of how to fill the form out where you don't mislead Social Security, but also you don't tell them that you can do things you can't do.
I think you just gave thousands of people a way out of vacuuming and cleaning tubs.
Absolutely. I think I'll use it myself.
Speaking of the lingo, help me with some of the lingo you're using. There's this term adjudicator.
What's an adjudicator?
Yeah, what's the adjudicator?
Well, adjudicator is basically somebody who works for the state, where the state agency. In other words, when you apply for disability, Social Security, the federal agency, has contracted with essentially the Medicaid office, the state offices that deal with Medicaid, to do the initial adjudication or initial decision-making. So these are people that are trained to look at the forms and look for certain terms to decide whether or not somebody is disabled. Again, hardworking people, but they're overwhelmed, they're overworked, and they are looking for very, very specific things. So the person, and you don't really have much interaction with this adjudicator, they're looking pretty much at paper, which again makes it even more important to have the forms filled out correctly. The adjudicator is the decision maker at the administrative level employed by the state that you live in, and they will make a decision or report back to Social Security, as opposed to a judge, who an administrative law judge, who is a federal Social Security employee, and they're looking at it in a much more broad sense. They're looking at big picture things as opposed to magic words.
So back to the guide that you put together, if I think I see some steps here where, let's see if I have this right. Put it this way. In the guide going through the forms are out there that people can commonly get forms from Social Security Disability and go this on their own, but what I see here...
Well, let me stop you there, because okay. Yes and no, because Social Security... the forms that are in the book are forms that I've collected over the years, and most of those forms are on the Internet and available to the public.
Okay.
However, there has been a push more recently to move people towards an electronic filing system. And so many of the forms are still there, but they're hidden. And if you don't know exactly where to look for them, you can't get them because they're trying to get people to file these things electronically. So the forms that are in the book are actually... the forms that are, most of the forms that are used, but the electronic forms, of course, are going to be the same questions, but a little bit different format. The big problem with the electronic filing is, number one, that it's not particularly reliable. Number two is that you don't really, you sort of answer one or two questions at a time. You don't get to look at the thing as a whole. And I know for me, when I'm filling out a form, I like to look at the whole thing to make sure that I'm not duplicating myself, to kind of know where I'm headed to.
Sure.
So the electronic forms don't really do that. So one of the benefits, I think, to my guide is that you can sort of see the whole thing. You can see what they're looking for and get a sense of really how to answer the questions fully. So that's one point about what the book can do. But the forms are available, and some of the forms are actually not on the Internet, you know, in a easily accessible locations. What will happen is Social Security will send it out to the claimant, at various times during the case and give you, you know, 10 or 15 days to get them filled in. So again, the advantage the book has is you've got all that stuff in front of you, so if you get one of these forms and you only have 10 days to fill it out, you've got a reference place you can go look for it.
Yeah, well, I know for my own work habits, if there's something that's important that I have that I really want to sit down, I print it off, and I like to have it in front of me in the physical format. So that's really what this is. You have the physical format of forms, right? That's one of
right.
the
Right, actually, I took all the forms that one would see in a Social Security disability case, printed them out, answered them, and then commented about why I answered them and the way I answered them. So every form may have two or three sample answers based on various medical conditions. And I also have commentary. This is what I did and why I did it, so that anybody filling it out can understand really the big picture, not both the, let's call it the macro and the micro, big picture, what you're trying to prove, and examples of here's language you can actually use. You can cut and paste it and use it in your own application, your own appeals, so that you can get the best possible result. Because, again, the goal here is to get people approved at the early stages before it gets to a judge. Because remember, when it gets to when you request a hearing, you may be looking at 2 or 3 years. So the goal here is to get people approved early on, get people approved in, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, as opposed to 3 or 4 years.
Okay, now it's starting to come together. So all of these testimonials of people that have used your guide and have had great results with it, does it really come down to this, is that the guide has everything in front of you in a paper format? That's easy to use. That's not the real key to success. But the answers are filled out correctly, and on to kind of speaking the language, so that when these forms go in, the first stop that they're going to make is at this adjudicator level. Is that right?
That's correct.
And
that's
so you
correct.
Need to...
I was going to say, and the adjudicators realize they're used to getting sort of this very sloppy handwritten, you know, it doesn't really say anything. And so all of a sudden somebody comes in with a complete package. It's filled out correctly. There's medical documents associated with it. It's just done professionally. It looks completely different. And it stands out. And again, some of the comments I get, people will say, you know, the adjudicator would call me up. One guy wrote me and said, the adjudicator called me up. He said, this is the most comprehensive package I've ever received. I'm not saying that every case is going to be like that, but when you do it correctly, it stands out so much that these adjudicators, you're making their life easy. Again, this is sort of a general rule of life. If you've got to perform something for a teacher or for a judge or whomever, a decision maker, you make their life easy. Guess what? You know, they're going to make your life easy.
Yeah.
So you're helping them do their job because you're actually providing this documentation to them in a form they can use easily. They don't have to dig for it.
In the language
that's,
you
that's
know
the,
they're
that's
looking
the big
for.
Point.
Yeah. It's really a beyond a slight edge. It's a pretty significant edge. Okay. That's great to know. That explains why all these people are giving you the rave reviews that they are. Let's start with some of the nuts and bolts here. And how does somebody go about really figuring out if they qualify for a Social Security disability? What really is the first step to get started into this?
Well, the first step is to determine whether or not they think that they meet the definition of disability. And the definition of disability is basically whether you have a medically determinable condition or conditions that prevents you from performing substantial activity that has lasted a year or is expected to last a year and result in death. So essentially, you've got to have some sort of a medical problem, medically based problem, a diagnosed problem, that leaves you unable to perform any kind of work. And again, not just past work, but anything at all, a simple sit-down, unskilled type of job that's going to last a year or longer, or could result in death. So that's the standard. So question one is, do you meet that? And of course, the precursor to that would be, are you working now? I mean, if you're working, by definition, you're not disabled.
Okay.
So you've got to, first of all, show you're not working, and secondly, do you have a medical problem that leaves you unable to perform any kind of work?
So this means somebody's got to go and see a doctor and get a doctor's opinion on this. Is that correct?
I don't know. I think you necessarily have to go before you apply, but I think that at some point you're going to have a doctor support you. I mean, I think if you go to Social Security and you say, you know, I can't work, I hurl all the time, but I don't really know why, what is the judge going to do with that? Because he needs to know why you can't work. I mean, what if it's something that can be fixed with, you know, a very simple procedure or just some medication? So again, if it's something that is easily cured, then I don't know if that's going to be a disability. Now, that's not to say that Social Security insists that you have surgery on something, but again, there are certain medical conditions, maybe if it's a vitamin deficiency, could be easily fixed and you wouldn't be disabled anymore. So I think that you probably need to have medical support behind you if you expect to win. There's no cost to apply, though. I mean, you can apply, but I think to win, maybe they answered the question, but yes, you need to have a doctor or a mental health professional in your corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So you get a good understanding from a doctor that, you know, there's something up here that might warrant or qualify you for a Social Security disability benefits, and doctors have a pretty good idea about this? Are they in tune with what the qualifications are?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that doctors, you know, are focused on treating people. They're not necessarily focused on their work capacity. I think there's some doctors that they don't believe in disability at all. So I think it's important that for somebody who is disabled, maybe again to kind of restate this, you know, people don't wake up one day and say, I'm disabled. It's usually something that happens over, unless it's a traumatic injury, mm-hmm. It usually happens over a period of time, and you just realize that at some point in time you just are missing so much work that you're getting write-ups at the job, or you're missing time from work and you can't perform it, or you get fired repeatedly, something like that. That would be a pretty good indication that there may be something going on here that could qualify you for disability.
Okay.
And if you've got a doctor who says, you know, looking at this diagnosis, you've got a heart problem that is going to continue to cause you problems. I had a case involving diabetes two days ago, and the guy had been diagnosed with diabetes about 5 or 6 years ago, and for the past 5 years, his diabetes has not been under control. And, of course, when you have out-of-control diabetes, it begins to affect, you know, various body systems, your organs, it affects your eyes and your hands and feet and so forth, and it had gotten to the point where he just cannot function. He's so fatigued because of all these problems that he can't function at all. So it's really, you've got to know your own body, and you've got to have a doctor that supports you. So I think that, you know, that's the starting point, is to understand, you know, that you really can't work at all, you can't do anything, and to have a doctor who will agree that, yes, there is a problem. Now, doctors, as I said, don't necessarily think about disability, and some of the time what you've got to do is educate them a little bit. You know, one of the things that I tell people to do is print out a listing. And the list, for the purpose of explaining what that is, Social Security has published a list, if you will, of medical of body systems that if you meet one of these listings, you are disabled. There are 14 body systems, musculoskeletal and respiratory and digestive, skin, endocrine, et cetera, and what I do a lot of times is I'll print out the listing and take it to the doctor and say, does this person meet this listing? Are they disabled? So you've got to educate the doctors a little bit, too.
Mm-hmm. It might be something that'd be good for us to have on our site.
It is. Well, in fact, I've got in the guide, the CD version of it, I have a computer file of all the listings.
Oh, perfect.
So that somebody can reference that. Because, again, listing is one way to win disability. There's another way called functional capacity argument, but the first place you look is, do they meet a listing, or at least come up with a general category. What part of the body, what body systems, and maybe one, and maybe five or six, which ones are involved here? So you can start developing kind of an approach to your case. So I think the step one would be to kind of understand, to sort of have a sense in your own mind that I'm not able to work because I hurt here or something is wrong here, then to sort of take that and kind of begin speaking Social Security's language by associating what's going on in your life with their topics, their topic headings, their systems, their 14 systems, and figure out which ones are involved. So now you're starting to talk their language. So when you can approach them, you can say, you know, we're dealing here with a cardiac problem, and this is listing level. This is the listing four. So you can look at number four and see which issues are involved.
Oh, this is great. Great. So, again, it's a couple things I've learned here is that one is it's not really the condition that you have and how severe it is. It's how that condition affects your ability to work. Am I accurate in that? Okay.
Absolutely.
The second thing is, we're talking as one of these major steps, is if you have a medical situation, is that you need to take that medical situation and have it verified by a doctor and then tie it into a listing if possible.
Absolutely.
Okay, so in that listing, and that listing can then be worked on with your guide, and the language can be put in the guide, so that listing information goes through in this wonderful format that's going to land in front of this adjudicator, and then they're going to go like, wow, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Again, here's an example. The cardiac listing, you know, for heart problems, talks about something called an ejection fraction, which means how much blood your heart is pumping. Well, if your medical record shows that your ejection fraction is at whatever listing level or close to it, you can point that out in your forms. You're making the adjudicator's life a lot easier because you're pointing them to exactly what they're looking for.
So why is
know what they're looking for?
Why is a listing so important in this process? I mean, a listing is just these 14 things, right? Does it mean anything else? So you've got it tied so it's referenceable.
Right. The listing is simply it's the body systems, and each listing may have 10 or 15 parts, and listing 4.03, for example, or 4.7 might be a very specific description of a heart problem. One might be a pumping problem. One might be congestive heart failure. There's different diagnoses within these listings, but it's a classification scheme. It's a way to classify what's wrong with you. And Social Security, when they adjudicate cases, they have to go through a five-step process. And again, step one is, are you working? Step two, I think, is, do you meet a listing? I don't have them off the top of my head, but one of the steps is, do you meet a listing?
Okay.
So that's sort of the first step you go to. I think step three is your functional capacity. Step four, past work. And step five is any work at all. So the listing is sort of the first step that Social Security goes through to see whether or not you meet the requirements for disability.
Okay. And if you do meet the listing requirements, does that give you any special treatment?
You're automatically approved.
Automatically approved?
Automatically, if you meet the listing, because each listing has built into it functional limitations. So if you look at any of the listings, it's presumed, it's sort of an abbreviated version of the functional capacity evaluation, but it's presumed that if you have congestive heart failure and your heart is only pumping 10% of its normal volume, mm-hmm. then you're disabled. If you meet a listing, you're automatically approved. So the quick and dirty way to get approved is to meet a listing. So if your doctor says, yes, you meet the listing, then you take a printout of the listing to the doctor and say, okay, here's the listings for immune system, or here's the listings for skin disorders, and we'll find one that matches what's going on with me and write a letter to Social Security saying that I meet the listing and why, and then you win.
Just like that. So that's your key. That's one of your keys to success. That's why the folks that have worked with you and used the guide and met a listing are waltzing right through the system. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of times it's something just as simple as pointing out in the record where you meet the listing.
Okay.
Now, I will tell you, to be fair, that listings are difficult to meet. They make them hard. I mean, they don't make them easy to meet. But there are far too many cases that I get at hearing where somebody clearly meets the listing but never, spelled it out clearly enough in their initial application, and they ended up having to wait 3 or 4 years when they should have been approved early. I mean, there's a couple of cases I speak about this a lot, and one case in particular comes to mind where I had a lady that when we brought her into the hearing, they had to wheel her in a gurney. She couldn't stand up. I mean, her back was so far gone, she could not move. Yet we had to go to a hearing. I had a case about 6 months ago where my client had MS so bad that she couldn't get out of her car. I actually videotaped her. She came to my office for a pre-hearing conference. I had to videotape her, and she was stuck in her car. We had to call the paramedics to physically remove her from her car. That's how bad off she was. Yet why is this person going to a hearing? Because obviously, at the earlier stages, nobody pointed out, or the doctor wouldn't ask the right question, that this person met a listing. And there's, story after story like this, but some of those ones that really jump out at me, I mean, how could a person who physically cannot move not be disabled?
Mm.
And clearly they were, but they just, it wasn't spelled out.
So the whole ambition here, or the objective number one, is to try to meet that listing. Quickest way
through. Absolutely. And I would say, maybe 10, 12% of the people that apply are listing level people. So most people are not going to meet a listing, but the ones that do should really get approved early.
Okay, so 10 to 12% of those applications that are approved are listing level? Is that what I mean?
I don't have the specific. I'm just saying that's just my estimate based on what I see.
Okay.
From my side of it, that when I get a case, about 10 to 12% of the cases that we see, we get approved early because they're listing level.
Okay.
Statistically, it may be around that, maybe a little higher, a little lower. I would guess it's probably 10, 15, no more than 20% of people that meet the listing. So they're hard to meet, but if you can meet them, then that's the way to go. And at the very least, if you don't meet the listing, it's important to sort of categorize yourself so you kind of know what area you're dealing with. Again, so one of the things that you don't want to do in Social Security is have this kind of undifferentiated, vague complaints of pain. That's not going to do anything. You've got to be able to tie it to something.
Okay. So you mentioned something previously, Jonathan, that there's two ways. There's the listing process that you clearly outlined for us, and then the second one was functional capacity. Okay.
Right, and the technical name for it is residual functional capacity. Sometimes when you're looking at Social Security forms, you'll see an abbreviation RFC, which again stands for residual functional capacity.
All right.
That is a legal term. Residual means what's left over. Functional means your capacity to function, and capacity obviously is your ability to do things. So the issue in a functional capacity case is what capacity do you have left over after we take into account your medical problems and the associated complications. And what you're trying to get at in most cases is that your functional capacity leaves you unable to perform any kind of work, even at a sit-down, unskilled, low-stress type of environment. And that's what you're looking to show. So that your capacity is not looking at your past work, it's looking at anything at all. And actually what happens in hearings is the judges will have vocational witnesses, people who have knowledge about different kinds of jobs that exist in the economy, and they will pose questions. They'll say, assume I have a hypothetical person, the same age, education, work experience as our claimant here, and assume further I find that his functional capacity is limited to light work. And in addition to light work, he has the following impairments, and the judge will go through a various list of impairments. You know, that he cannot climb ladders, ropes, or scaffolds. He's got a moderate level of pain. He's got, a breathing limitation, so he can't be around dusty environments. Based on that hypothetical, could this person perform his past work? And if not, could he perform any kind of work at all? So the job in a functional capacity, my job in a functional capacity case is to argue that there's so many limitations that even if we add them all to this hypothetical question, that the vocational witness is going to have no choice but to say, no jobs, person couldn't work. That's what we're trying to do. So really it's a building of limitations. Again, the doctor is translating the medical problems into work limitations. We're taking those work limitations and adding them to a profile. And the more we get, the less likely there's going to be jobs the vocational witness can find for us.
Okay, so throughout the guide, do you instruct people how to use the right language to express functional or work limitations?
Absolutely, because again, most cases are decided that way, so a lot of the language in there, if they're filing these appeals, they probably have not met a listing.
Okay.
So we talk about, describing, and again, here's a good example. You know, when I talk to people before hearing, I'll say, well, how far can you walk? Yeah, not very far. How much can you lift? Not too much. Well, that doesn't tell us anything. Right? I mean, if what is too far, what is not very much.
Oh, I see.
So one of the things you want to do is you want to talk about specifics. I can lift no more than, 10 pounds frequently or occasionally and 5 pounds frequently. Or I can walk no more than 30 yards before I have to stop. That's giving a functional, that's a capacity, right? That, 50 yards or 20 pounds, 10 pounds, those are limitations on capacity. So if you have enough limitations, that's going to help you win your case. And again, if you don't understand this and you put on the form, I can't walk very far, what is the adjudicator going to do with that? Nothing. But if you say, I can only walk 15 or 20 yards, that translates into this person could not perform a job over the light exertional level. And again, I explain what those terms are as well, but they're various terms that Social Security uses. So what you want to do is when you talk about, you know, your physical activities, you want to be very, very specific and talk about what you can and cannot do. Example, a gallon of milk weighs 8 pounds. So if you can't lift a gallon of milk, you would put in there, you know, I can't lift a gallon of milk. It's very difficult. Even with 2 hands, I can maybe carry it 2 or 3 feet, then it might fall. That's basically telling us that your functional capacity for lifting is probably less than light, which is good. That helps. That's one of the building blocks.
Painting a real clear picture.
Okay.
That's what needs to be done. That's right.
You need to
be specific in what, you know, how far you can walk, what you can lift.
Absolutely. You
how long you can stay awake.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. As many of these things that you can put numbers to, the better.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be as specific as you can so that when you answer these questions about daily living, for example, you can put in there that I have to sleep or I have to take a break for 30 minutes every 2 hours. Well, again, translate that into a work setting. How many jobs do you know would let you take a 30-minute break every 2 hours?
Mm.
None. So, and then any vocational witness will testify that that's not going to work because you can't. No employer is going to let you do that outside of a sheltered work situation. So again, you want to seed your record. You want to put those things in the record so that you are consistently saying that. And if you have your doctor back you up, then you have a much, much better chance at winning because now you are talking Social Security's language. You are instructing them, and you are providing proof that your capacity for work has been so reduced that you could not perform any type of competitive work at all.
Okay, so a brief recap here in this medical area is that the listing being step number one that somebody wants to go to, and then you clearly explained that, find the 14 criteria, try to match it up, and have it pop up in front of the adjudicator. Then the functional capacity part is paint a very clear picture of your limited ability to work is the second way to win a case, right?
Well, I would say work or work-like activities.
Work-like activities.
Right. Any type of physical activity, or even for that matter, you know, mental activity that would impact a work environment.
Yeah, yeah. And this ties back into the whole scrubbing the bathtub and vacuuming concept.
Absolutely.
Okay, people need to be aware of. I'm going to jump around a little bit here, but this is a question that's been commonly asked of us as well. It's like the whole money thing that's tied into this. How much money do people get paid? How do they find out? Is it true that some people actually don't even qualify? I mean, there's no money in the system for them. Can you tell us how all that works and plays
sure.
into this?
Well, Social Security, you know, is a part of the same system that pays retirement benefits. The big difference is that retirement Social Security looks at your lifetime earnings. Social Security disability looks at your earnings for the last 10 years, basically. So it is more recent history. You have got to show that you have earned enough money over the last 10 years to qualify you to insure you for disability benefits. And Social Security has kind of an interesting formula, and I'll just give you, for example, for 2006, you have... Here we go. For 2006, if you earn $970, you are earning one credit. $3,880 would be 4 credits for the year. So you need to show that you have got 20 out of 40 credits available in the last 10 years. So over 5 years, you would potentially earn 20 credits. 10 years would be 40 credits. You've got to have 20 credits in the last 10 years. And that's basically how it works. So you've got to pay into the system through Social Security taxes. You've got to build enough income into that, or build enough payments into that system that you can get something out. So if somebody comes to me and they last worked 15 years ago, they're not going to be insured for Title II disability. They might be insured for, or they might be eligible for SSI, which is a different animal, but for disability, it's got to be recent and it's got to be, within the last 10 years, basically.
So $3,880 is not, you know, you don't have to be a rock star to make that type of money. That's right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
so right. So if I have somebody who, you know, if this is 2006 and somebody has been working since, you know, let's say they worked from 1994 to 2004 pretty consistently, they're going to be insured. Typically when you stop working, your insurability follows you for another 2, 3, 4 years. And then as long as you can prove you became disabled prior to the date you were last insured, you're okay. And basically the form you can find out, you know, what I tell people is when they call Social Security to ask them, what is my date first insured for disability? What is my date last insured? So there should be some dates there that you can kind of know you're working with. You've got to show that you became disabled during that time period. So it's kind of like paying an insurance premium, but of course it's Social Security taxes instead. And if you are insured, and there's a form you can fill out. It's a form 7008, which I think is available on Social Security's website. It's in the book, and it's pretty available. But that's a good way to find out how much money you would get. Typically, you're going to get a payment that's going to be a percentage of what you paid in. So typically, what I'm seeing are anything from $800-$900 a month to maybe $1,800-$2,000 a month of a monthly benefit. It's kind of typical.
So you're saying in the guide you have a form that you can fill out and send in and find out, you know, how
yes.
much money you, how many credits, all that jazz?
That's correct. So
okay.
Form 7008.
So when do you suggest people do this?
Immediately.
Immediately.
Most of the time, in fact, a lot of people, if you've ever requested one, they send you one every year automatically. So it's not a bad idea to go ahead. Everybody should really do it. There's an address in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and you can send away for it, and they start sending it to you every year. And it'll tell you how much you would get on disability. It'll tell you if you get enough credits. But it's important to know that because there are a few situations I've been involved in where somebody has 19 credits and they need 20. So I may tell them you need to go back and find a way to earn that $970 to get that extra credit so you can be insured for Title II disability. Here's why. If you're not insured for Title II, you're left with SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And SSI, the maximum you're going to get is going to be about $550-$600 a month. And it's also subject to offsets if you have any household income, if you have any kind of assets. It's much more limited than Title II disability.
Okay,
so you're much better off in general with Title II.
So Title II is not big bucks, but bigger bucks, right?
Bigger bucks.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Title II is also called SSDI. People sometimes hear that term, SSDI, Title II, Social Security Disability, versus SSI, Title 16, or Supplemental Security Income.
And what was the number of that form again?
7008.
7008?
Yep.
Okay. It's in the guide anyway. Okay.
It is.
All right. Let's get back to some of the, lifestyle conditions and things that are asked of us about, you know, how they affect Social Security disability application. I'll use one specific one that's come in here, and we had a person write in and said, I drank 6 cans of Pabst Blue Ribbon and drove my car, and I thought it was great, but the officer that pulled me over didn't, and I'm trying to file for Social Security disability. Is this gonna affect anything?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it comes up not infrequently, and that is that if alcohol or drug abuse is a what they call a material contributing factor to the disability, then the person is not eligible for benefits. So when I've got somebody who's got an alcohol issue in their background, and again, it's in those medical records, and medical records, by the way, you got to be very careful and when you talk to your doctor, because if the doctor senses that you're looking, you're drug-seeking, you're looking for going from doctor to doctor to get, narcotic prescriptions, or there's a discussion of alcoholism in there, that can be a real, real problem because Social Security sees that, and they'll cut you off or they'll deny you on that basis. But, yeah, that's, it's got to be, if alcohol is involved, then there's got to be something else, at least in my take, there's got to be something else that would make the person disabled. Or the alcohol use has got to be so long and damaging that the person has some sort of organ damage. In other words, if you drink consistently for 15, 20 years, then your liver is probably going to have elevated liver enzymes, and it could be your disability might stem from the damage to your liver, even if you stop drinking. But yeah, if someone has been drinking, that's definitely not a good thing. And I will tell you from my experience that any time a judge sees that, they automatically get very, very concerned, and those cases are very unlikely to be approved.
Okay.
A second area that comes up, in fact, it came up in my office yesterday, I get letters from prisoners quite frequently that they feel that they're disabled. If you're in prison or in a state mental hospital, you're not eligible for benefits until you get out. I will tell you right now that the judges are not real fond of approving people who have long prison records, because that, it just affects their credibility. So those are a couple of areas you got to really watch out for.
So if you're a felon, you have to be very conscious about that, as well as alcohol or drug-related addictions or convictions.
Right. It used to be, I mean, years ago, alcoholism or drug abuse could be the basis for a disability because, again, it's perceived by, I think, the American Medical Association as a disease. But I think there was a, you know, a couple of these reports on various TV programs where people who were drug addicts were using, you know, Social Security tax money, their money from taxpayers, to support their habits, and so they took that out. That's probably not a bad thing. I think those people were probably just making things worse for themselves. But yeah, that's something that, you know, when I look at a case, I'm very, very concerned about if I see any kind of alcohol or drug use.
Yeah.
And I always tell people you need to get, you know, help and get sober, because judges will many times not approve the person until they feel that they are sober. The other thing is that people who are alcoholics or drug users sometimes tend to be a little optimistic about, you know, when they stopped or have they stopped, and judges are very aware of that as well.
Okay. And moderation is really is okay, but just don't abuse it.
Yeah, I mean, I even tell people, I mean, to my mind, I just think that any time, really, alcohol and drug use should not even be a part of a disability record. So, you know, of course, you take clients as you find them, but, you know, if somebody has got that in their record where they've had some issues with abuse of substance, and that is a factor that might lead me not to take a case, because those cases are more difficult. Some judges are just, you know, knee-jerk, going to react to that, and they're just not going to approve those people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not saying that every one of them. I'm just saying that's just another factor to consider. And what I would say is, if it's there, if a claimant has had some drug issues, they need to make sure that it's very clear in the record that they are past that is over and done with. They're not actively engaging in those activities, because that will, you know, that can maybe cut that off in the past. And of course, biggest thing is don't lie about it. You know, if somebody has had problems, they've had relapses, acknowledge it, deal with it, but don't lie about it, because it'll show up in the record.
Okay. Here's the sensitive subject, and you talked about it briefly in the beginning. I mean, the process to receive benefits is long. If you meet a listing, then, you know, 6 to 8 months, and that's the minority of the cases. So the question that that we hear is, how do you survive? I mean, what do people do? Do you have any advice for them, or tips, or how do you address that?
It's tough. It's a real tough one. I mean, a lot of people end up moving in with family or friends, and they struggle. And I think that, you know, part of it is to have a realistic expectation of what's going to happen, so that you don't expect things to happen quickly, to realize this is a marathon, not a sprint, so you've got to keep going to the doctor, you know, to make sure that your loved ones understand that this is not going to be something that's going to be very, very quick and rapid. It's a real problem. It is a real problem, and I think that's one of the things that Social Security is trying to grapple with, to make the process a little bit shorter, but we'll just see how that happens. I have had some success when people are facing foreclosure or facing, you know, imminent being on the street, where they can turn to their elected representatives, and sometimes those cases, we call them dire need cases, can be moved to the front. That is much less effective than it was a few years ago.
Okay.
But every once in a while, if somebody, especially if they have a terminal condition and they are dying, those cases will sometimes be moved to the front if you get an elected representative, senator, or congressman involved.
What about working through this? I mean, we talked about that before. I think you mentioned it wasn't, if you're working and that's noted in your application, then they're saying, well, why do you need Social Security disability? Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point. You know, people say to me all the time, well, can I work part-time? Here's how I've sort of come down on this, is that on one hand, a failed work attempt is helpful to your case, because it, number one, shows good faith, and number two, it shows that you are, you know, you're trying to do something, but you can't. So clearly, if someone is, you know, motivated to work but can't do it, that's positive evidence. If you've got, you know, five or six work attempts where you last two or three weeks at a particular place and you get fired because of absenteeism or because of inability to get through a work day, then that can be good evidence. Where I run into trouble is when somebody has got work attempts where they've worked 3 or 4 months. And really, once you get beyond 3 months, it stops being a work attempt and it looks more like a job. I think that muddies the water. So I would never tell somebody not to work, but I would just tell them if they do work and they get beyond 3 or 4 months, that is going to make it more difficult to prove they're disabled. Because No matter what job you have, there's probably something a little bit easier out there. And a judge would conclude, well, if they could last 6 or 8 months at a, you know, a job in a warehouse, maybe they could do something full-time, you know, as a textile inspector or as a hand packer. So in my view, work efforts, if it gets beyond a field work attempt, can be detrimental to a case.
Okay. Good to know.
Social Security tends to see, basically, Social Security sees things in black and white. Shouldn't be this way, but it is. They see things in black and white. If you are working, then you are by definition, not disabled.
So do you have direct advice for your clients?
Direct advice in the sense that I tell them, you know, they say to me, can I try to work? I said, sure, go try to work, but be aware that if you last more than, say, 2 or 3 months, that is going to, you know, it may put you in a closed period situation where we're asking for disability from a period of time that comes to an end, or it may change our onset date. We may find that our onset date has been moved forward so that you don't get as much back benefits.
But
if you got to eat, you got to eat. But again, Social Security's attitude is, if you got to eat and you can work, then you're not disabled.
Yeah, it's really a catch-22.
It is.
I mean, it's tough. To, I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn here, but the cleaner way is to not work, because then there's no area for confusion. I'm not working and I can't work. Here's my deal.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Back to the amount of money that people get paid real quickly. Does everybody get paid the same amount of money? Tell me how that works again.
Well, they get paid based on something called the PIA, which is a calculation that Social Security does, looking at their household, looking at their what they paid into the system. And it's a function. It's a mathematical algorithm. I couldn't begin to explain to you exactly how it works, but it is a number that is a function of what they've paid into the system. So somebody who's been a high earner, who's earned $100,000 a year, they're going to be getting, you know, a lot more money than somebody who's been earning $15,000 or $20,000 a year.
Okay. All right. The other thing, I noticed that in some of your work, back on the tips and tricks that you work to go through the system, you actually advise people, now tell me if I'm speaking out of turn here, Jonathan, but you advise people to claim a state of depression to work through their case, which,
yep.
That sounds kind of wild to me, but I'm anxious to hear about it.
Yeah, what I found, well, first of all, you have to realize why. The reason why is that Social Security, if you allege depression, they will schedule a consultative evaluation with a psychologist.
Okay.
And it doesn't cost anything. And basically, my experience has been that most of the time, these psychological consultative evaluations, let me speak correctly, they will find something that limits you in some fashion. And really, if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. If you have been working your whole life and you've been a productive, you know, self-sufficient individual, and now you can't work, there's probably going to be an element of depression, even if you don't realize it. And a lot of times, the psychological evaluations will uncover that. If you have any kind of learning issues that maybe went undiagnosed, they may uncover that because they do these various tests. So I find that in most cases, there's going to be an element of depression. At the very least, the psychologist will usually find something that could help your case. So I usually advise everybody, just as a matter of course, to allege depression, because it's probably there, number one. Number two is because it's probably going to generate something that will help your case.
Okay. Well, you know, I look at it this way. If I am, as a guy, speaking to other guys out there, if I was unable to work and my livelihood was taken away from me and I am providing, which a lot of guys do, whether it's for yourself or for your family, I can see where somebody would have an altered mental state which may cause depression. That's just absolutely my take. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a
right
researcher. But I see that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. If you led a certain lifestyle, if you've had a certain vision of yourself and sort of sense of yourself, and all of a sudden that's completely changed, of course you're going to be depressed about it. And
mm-hmm.
that's a very reasonable thing. And I think that a lot of, especially men, don't necessarily recognize it. A lot of times spouses do. But really for anybody, I think it's probably not a bad idea to at least have that evaluated. And again, 9 times out of 10 it will result in something that is beneficial to me.
Okay.
And you know what? If it doesn't, if it comes back that there's nothing wrong, then you're no worse off.
Okay.
Now, by contrast, Social Security, if you allege, you know, any kind of physical problem, which in most cases are going to involve that, they'll send you out to a physical consultative evaluation as well. That's a different animal because those rarely help. Those are typically the IME type of doctors that you see in workers' compensation cases. They rarely find anything wrong with anybody. Judges give them very little weight. It's kind of a waste of time for everybody, but you got to go through the process. So in most cases, most claimants will find themselves being sent out for a physical evaluation and a mental health evaluation. The physical one's not going to do them a whole lot of good. The mental health one might. But you might as well get it.
Okay. Okay. Let's I'm going to look at this as kind of like somebody, from a recap point, trying to piece together midway through here what we've gone through, which is, you know, somebody comes through, they've gotten started, and we've talked about the guide and how the guide can benefit, you know, with the listing and the functional work capacity, and we've spoken a little bit about how long it takes, right? So if they don't meet a listing, it could be 2.5-3 years, right?
Could be. It depends on where they live. And again, some places are faster than others. But I think that, you know, a couple of years is probably a minimum. And, you know, 3 to 4 years is in the worst case.
Okay. So we've really zeroed in on the listing part. And I just, you know, I hate to keep going over this, but these questions are asked so many times. I just want to make it clear to people that, you know, what the key steps are. So... are there any other things that you can think of that are important that we may have missed that should be discussed in, you know, in coming through, getting started, getting that form 7008, determining the medical problem, seeing if you match your listing in the functional capacity part?
Just a couple of points. One would be that there's a very short appeal deadlines. When you get turned down, you have only 60 days to file your appeal. So when you get your denial notice, assuming you get you're denied, you want to do two things. Number one is you want to make sure that you file your appeal within 60 days of that denial notice. Because if you don't, then you basically have to start over again. So that's important to do. And a lot of times they don't necessarily send you the form, the blank form. You have to either request it or get it from the online. So you want to give yourself plenty of time and not wait till the last minute to do it. But the appeal deadlines are very important. If you miss them, you know, maybe there are some cases you can argue, you know, that you couldn't fill it out because of some medical condition or mental health condition, but it's best not to get involved. That's best to do them on time and get them done early. Again, that's part of what the guide will help you do is to get these forms filled out, because 60 days seems like a lot of time, but if you're, you know, sick and uncomfortable, it can zip by. So be very aware of that. Second thing is when you get the denial notice, look at it, because it will say on the denial notice what medical records were used to make that denial. And you'll find that a lot of times Social Security does not have all the medical records on hand when they make their decision. And the reason for that is that when Social Security, the adjudicator, takes the file and you provided them a list of all your doctors with names and addresses and so forth, if the doctor does not respond, if the address has changed, Social Security only waits a certain amount of time. And if they don't get those records back, then they just go with what they have. So I have several cases I've seen where people have, you know, got really strong medical records, never got to the file. The case was denied. And simply by providing those records, which I had in my office by that point, we got the case approved. So it's real important to see what they've got and to kind of keep track of what they have to make sure they've got all the medical records. Because, again, all they can do is request them. They don't do a lot of follow-up. They don't have the time or inclination to do so. but you as the claimant or you as the claimant's attorney, you can get on the phone, you can push the doctor to provide these records. Because realize doctors' offices are under budget crunches like anybody else, mm-hmm. their reimbursements are down, and, you know, making copies of medical records is kind of at the bottom of their list. Mm-hmm. And you got to sometimes push them. Social Security will pay, I think, $10 or $20 for this stuff. But for many doctors, that's not enough money to justify the effort. They just ignore them, ignore the letters. So it's important to look at those letters to see, make sure you've got everything you know, covered. And again, that's why you have your own file.
So this is really good advice for somebody that may have already started the application process.
Absolutely. You want to keep everything that they've given you, and you want to read it and look at it and see. Because, again, a lot of it's form. You know, it's just boilerplate where they'll say, we denied you because this, that, and the other. But they'll say the following records were used to make this decision. And they'll list the doctors and the dates of the records. And if you see something big is missing, then you know there's a gap to be filled that you can fill it. That may speed the process up a little bit.
Okay, I'm gonna move forward a little bit. You've done a great job of outlining that for us. Now, can you bring us through this part of the program and address the confusion that people have as to when to get an attorney, if they need an attorney? I'm hearing here, if you can go and meet a listing, you don't need an attorney. All you need to do is get the guide, right?
Correct.
So, when does an attorney come into play here? I mean, you see advertising everywhere, really, for this. So,
right. Well, basically,
tell us what we need to know.
Okay. I mean, first of all, realize how attorneys get paid, and that is that we attorneys are paid typically 25% of any past due benefits. So, in other words, if somebody applies, you know, in January 1, but they allege an onset date of, you know, 2 years, March 2 years ago, there may be a couple years of back benefits involved here. And so by the time we get to a hearing, maybe 2 or 3 years or 4 years. So attorneys get paid 25% of any past due benefits. So typically
there's a lot of money.
Could be a lot of money. And basically it's up to $5,300. So,
oh, okay.
You know, nowadays, right, it's capped. I mean, unless you can ask for additional fees if you've done more work, but most people do what they call the fee agreement. So, you know, typically when I win a case, I'll get checks for $5,225, which is, there's a user fee involved, but basically that's what attorneys end up getting paid for these cases. So if you've got, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 of back benefits, which is not at all uncommon, the attorney's going to get paid 25% of that.
Wow.
Now, attorneys, you know, and I'm an attorney, but I'm telling you that the truth as I see it is that really there's not much we can do at the initial stage because the Social Security's got to do its thing there. Even at the reconsideration stage, which is a phase they're trying to move out, they're trying to get rid of it, still there in most places right now, not really much we can do. I usually get involved in cases when there is a hearing to be scheduled. So if somebody gets denied at the initial application or denied at reconsideration, then I'll get involved to request a hearing.
Because that's
where I really earn my money.
Okay, we want to finish this topic, but can you tell us what is reconsideration? And maybe let me give an example. Let's say somebody comes through and they fill out the paperwork and it goes through, whizzes by the adjudicator, and take it from there. How does this...
Okay. Here's the time frame. Somebody applies, it goes to the adjudicator, the state agency adjudicator.
Mm-hmm.
It will usually take about 6 to 8 months to collect medical records and evaluate it with the help of in-house physicians and other experts at the state agency office.
Okay.
So typically about 6 to 8 months after you file, you'll get a letter from Social Security saying, we have denied your claim. And, of course, a lot of them a lot of good cases are denied. You then have 60 days to file for what is called reconsideration. And, again, reconsideration does not exist in every location. There's a number of different programs to eliminate it because it's such a waste of time. But it's still in a lot of places, so let's talk about it. Reconsideration is essentially where you fill out additional forms to update the record. It goes back to the same people that denied it the first time. And again, if let's say something was missing and you provided it, that's when the adjudicator can make a decision, approve a reconsideration. Statistically, very, very, very few cases are approved a reconsideration. Again,
can I ask a question here?
Yes.
If somebody at reconsideration, if somebody sends in their original paperwork and they don't know about your secret and the guide and the listing strategy and they refile their paperwork at the reconsideration level, is there a chance that they could meet a listing?
Sure, absolutely. And, they, okay. And again, a reconsideration is not a refiling. It is simply you're asking for a reconsideration of the initial denial notice.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, they're looking for the same thing. And, again, the cases that are approved or reconsideration, I think, are ones where the medical record has kind of straggled in, you know, the doctor was late and it finally got there, or they, something new has happened, and the adjudicator, you know, has a justification for approving it. Now, again, I've had several cases where a customer bought my guide after the initial denial, before the reconsideration, and when they filled out the reconsideration forms, which is a whole different set of forms, they did it right and they got approved there. But statistically, reconsideration is a very low level of approval. I think your chances improve if you know what you're doing, of course, but it's relatively low level of approval system-wide.
Okay.
So, again, the reconsideration process is going to take another 6 to 8 months, and now we're probably at, you know, 12 to 16 months into the process. You get a denial notice from reconsideration. It looks very similar to the one you got from the initial denial. Then you have 60 days or 2 months to file for a hearing, to request a hearing. And at that point, the file physically is moved from the state agency office to the Office of Hearings and Appeals. And that is moving from the state of whatever, state of Georgia, state of Alabama, state of New York, to the Office of Hearings and Appeals in a federal government office building. And that's where the judge will actually look at the file. That process is where the two, you know, 1.5 to 3 years goes into play. And I did a little research on this, and according to the government's own statistics, the amount of time, the typical case is taking about 3 years start to finish nationwide. Social Security employees work on that file for a grand total of 7 days. So seven work days in 3 years.
Okay.
That's the government's own statistics.
So I see five steps here. Somebody applies, and it goes through the adjudicator, and the adjudicator reviews it, collects medical records, and typically sends you back a yay or a nay, and if it's denied, then there's reconsideration. You have 60 days to file, correct?
Correct, correct.
Put any additional information in there, something that was left out, the reasons why you
correct.
Still think it, okay. So that's sent in, and then there's 6 to 8 months may go by, and then if it's sent back, it's typically not approved at reconsideration. It would be denied, and then you'd have another 60 days to request a hearing, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So when you request that hearing, what's the time between the hearing is requested and the hearing is
done?
Is done.
Well, again, that's where the big delay is right
that's
now.
That's the biggest delay.
In Atlanta, it's 26 months.
Ooh.
The day you file that request or that appeal for a hearing, to the time the hearing is actually scheduled, it's over 2 years. Now, in other places, it's going to be a little bit less time, but in several jurisdictions, Georgia, Atlanta in particular, it's 24 to 26 months.
Okay.
And
so
if you think about it, the challenge there is, and there's a couple things that are important to point out about this delay. If you remember, at the initial and the adjudication section, you have adjudicators who are collecting medical records, at least requesting them. Once you request a hearing, there's no more adjudicators involved. There's nobody updating the file. So it's you or your attorney has got the sole responsibility for updating that file.
Make
sure the medical records are updated. So that's why when you say, when do you get an attorney, I think that's where it starts to make sense to get an attorney because, keeping the file updated and knowing how to do all that, starts to become, some work. And you gotta, there's a timing aspect involved in it. And, plus another factor is that if for some reason you didn't have something included in your initial application or your reconsideration, your attorney can get that in early on. Because you don't want to get to a hearing, all of a sudden the judge finds out for the first time you've got a bad knee. That needs to be brought up much, much earlier. And so an attorney, with a good attorney will look at the file and have a sense of what's the theory of our case, what do we need, and prepare the case for a hearing.
Okay, so after you requested a hearing, you're basically on your own. There's no more adjudicators. So
that's right.
So either way, if somebody really wants to venture out and do this whole process on their own and not get the guide, they just got to have impeccable records and know the language.
But I'll tell you, going to a hearing, if you're not an attorney and you're going without an attorney to a hearing, it's not pleasant. I mean, the judges are overworked, and they my opinion, this is just my opinion, but my sense is that most judges just get very frustrated with non-represented claimants because they have to take so much more time to explain the process to them.
Okay.
Files are rarely in right order, and the person normally doesn't have any real clear idea of what they're trying to prove.
Are there other people out there other than an attorney that could represent, to have a better understanding of the process than the regular Joe layman?
Well, Social Security does allow non-attorney reps to go. Non-attorney reps, and again, Social Security is unique in that you can actually represent somebody without being an attorney. Non-attorney reps, there's some good ones, there's some not so good ones. Again, they don't have, of course, not that every attorney is great either, but the nice thing about an attorney is you've got the screening process, the person's passed the bar exam. They probably have a certain level of capacity and capability. There's some non-attorney reps that do a good job, and there's some ones that don't do a very good job at all. So I personally think it's a little riskier to go with a non-attorney rep, but there's some good ones out there. I've been asked the question, what good does my guide do if you have already passed the reconsideration phase? And again, this comes to preparing the case for a hearing. One of the things I think that's important to do is to really have the forms filled out correctly, the functional capacity forms, the listing forms. And one of the things I've got in there is those forms. So I think that even if you have to go to a hearing, it can be valuable to have your file, done correctly. Mm. I've got a lot of attorneys who buy my book because they want to fill these forms out correctly as well.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm looking at this from a business perspective, from a guy sitting on your side of the fence as a lawyer, and why would I want to represent somebody if they are just, if they're just in the application process? Because the back benefits, that's what I would get paid on. I'm presuming that I've gone through all the hard work like you in education, and I'm a lawyer.
Right.
And, and we go through this, and somebody gets awarded like 6 to 8 months into it, and I do my job right, but Social Security, the compensation, I'm just getting a few months of back benefits. I'm not even at the $5,300 range.
Right. You're getting 25% of those few months. Plus, in Title II cases, there's a five-month waiting period, so they only pay the first 5 months. So, theoretically, you could be an attorney and do your job really well, get the person approved early, and get paid nothing. And I think that's really the ethical issue that, attorneys, we have an ethical obligation to our client that really exceeds our desire to get paid on things. The way I deal with it is this. I think that first of all, if you take on a case, you have an ethical obligation to try to win it and win it as early as you can. If you see you're not going to get paid on it, then don't take the case at that stage. I think most attorneys, again, this is one of the things that kind of led to this book, was most attorneys I know that do a lot of this work don't get involved in cases until the hearing stage because there's so little money involved in it early, and Social Security has a habit of sometimes if you do win it early, they'll cut your fee, they won't even pay the 25%, they'll pay you $400 or $500 and say that's all they're going to pay you because they don't see how you possibly could have done any more even if you've done a lot of work on it. So many attorneys don't want to mess with the case until it's at the hearing stage because, the chance to get paid is so dicey and so limited. That's a problem. And I think that, part of what I tried to fill the gap with here was to give some people some guidance as to how to do it at the initial and the recon stages with the understanding they're probably going to have a difficult time getting an attorney. And if they have an attorney, how hard is he going to really work knowing there's not very much money involved in it?
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about those that have been denied. They have 60 days to request a hearing. When they get that denial confirmation, should they request the hearing on their own, or should they at that point in time seek a lawyer? What's the exact moment they should, you suggest?
I personally think that they should probably get a attorney at the time they get denied. I mean, they can certainly fill out the hearing request form, and especially if they think that there is a really strong chance they're going to get approved. If they're running late, they can do it themselves. But I think it's probably a good idea to get an attorney involved to do that. Most attorneys, when you get involved in a case, you'll go ahead and fill out the forms, the hearing request form for the claimant. Again, there have been many cases, though, where I've gotten involved and the person's filed their own hearing request form because they didn't know about getting an attorney early enough or for whatever reason they waited. But, yeah, I mean, I think the best time to do it would be as soon as you get the denial notice from reconsideration.
Okay, this kind of leads us into some of the other work that you do, and you've done a lot of work beyond, you know, the Atlanta area in this, and it's actually remarkable. But we've worked out a program with you where you have established a network of lawyers that you've approved, given your stamp of approval, and they're set up throughout the U.S. that people can, you know, below this interview and on the site here, they can click on it, go in and fill out information, and they can actually find a lawyer. So tell us, I mean, what this, so if I'm somebody in Des Moines, Iowa, or I'm up here in Vermont, and I need a lawyer that, you know, can help me after I've been denied, you've gone out and built this network that you've allowed us to have access to. Somebody can fill out a form, doesn't cost anything, right? To
correct.
Request a lawyer, okay. And they don't have to use them, of course. But what I'm curious about is what criteria do you look for in the people that are in this network? I mean, how do you see who's good? Are they all good? It's, of course, that's a loaded question, but tell
right,
us about
right.
that.
Well, basically what I did was I you know, in the writing I've been doing with this, I talked to a lot of people, and, of course, there's national organizations that most attorneys who do this belong to, and you kind of get a sense of who's publishing things and who's reporting cases and things like that. And I just got on the phone, quite honestly, and started talking to people. This kind of developed. I'll tell you how it developed is when I wrote the book, initially I didn't have any kind of lawyer network, and I started getting emails and calls from people all over the country asking me, can you refer me to a lawyer? And so I was just literally getting on the phone and calling people and talking to them and saying, look, I've got somebody who just called me, and they're in California, they're in Florida or Texas or Nevada, and you know, I'm looking for, they need some help here. And I wasn't asking for anything. I just said, you know, I'm trying to find somebody who's good. And over the course of a number of months, I mean, I just sort of developed these contacts with people, and I finally decided, well, you know, this is something that I need to make a little more formal. And so some of the people that I had referred cases to, I called them back, and we talked. And, you know, when you talk to an attorney, you kind of get a sense, and I sort of know what I'm looking for. I mean, these are people that will take the time, if they're willing to talk to me and talk to the folks I was referring to them. You know, they have to show an interest in their client. They have to have, obviously have been experienced, have done this for a while. And that's where what I'm looking for is people just that have got some experience and that are nice people. You know, that, I mean, this is a difficult time in somebody's life. You know, you're disabled, you can't function, and you got to have an attorney who will return phone calls, who will work with you. And when you talk to attorneys who do this, you sort of just naturally start talking shop, and you just get a sense of who, you know, who does it the right way and who sort of has a good approach. And, you know, some of them, quite honestly, I kicked off the program. I didn't feel that they were doing what I want them to do. But I talk to these folks all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a pretty good sense just from talking to them that they've got the experience and they've got the background and the skill set to do a good job with the cases. And so those are the ones that I leave on the list.
Great. So just to reflect back to the guide works everywhere, right?
Right.
The Social Security disability playing field is United States. And then this network covers anybody that would need a lawyer
That's
throughout
correct.
The U.S.
Okay. That's correct. I've got lawyers literally people all over the country.
Okay.
And you know, some of them cover more than one state, but most of them are in the state that they practice in that state, and they cover that state. And again, you know, these are good folks, and I know them all, and I feel real comfortable with them.
Okay. Let's talk about some other categories. We have, people that have expressed, widows seeking pensions. That's one category that, you know, people would have questions about, and veterans seeking benefits. Does the guide provide any assistance to those categories?
It does not deal with veterans' disability. Veterans' disability is a completely different system.
Okay.
And I've done a little bit of that type of work, and it's not really actually designed for attorneys. There's no way for attorneys to get paid in veterans' cases, and therefore there's no veterans, not too much a veterans' bar that deals with that. Similar in the sense that it's asking disability questions, but the forms are totally different, and that would be a different book.
Okay.
And I'm actually toyed with that idea, but I haven't written it yet. The widow's issue is one where Social Security disability does allow a widow or widower to claim on the deceased spouse's earnings records if that widow or widower is 50 years old and became disabled within 7 years of the spouse dying. So you may have a housewife, which is a typical situation, who is 52 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Husband died 3 or 4 years ago, and the housewife is disabled. Social Security disability, the same forms would apply, and that, you know, disabled widow's claim would be based on the deceased spouse's earnings record.
Over 50.
So this would apply to that. This book would apply to that.
Okay. So that covers veterans and widows. Now, children, you do quite a bit of work for children. Tell us about
children's
that.
Children's cases are it's a different animal, and I've got a whole separate guide for child cases. And basically, child cases are all SSI because, obviously, the children have not worked. And SSI, child SSI, has a different set of standards. Basically, it's a different set of listings. In order to win a child SSI case, you have to essentially meet the listing. It used to be there was a different standard, but now it's pretty much you have to meet the listing. And so my child SSI book really focuses on answering the questions in terms of those listings. Because, again, this is not about functional capacity anymore. This is about do you meet the listing. A lot of the child cases that we see are ADHD or ADD, attention deficit problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there may be other child medical problems. But essentially, you've got to get forms from doctors that say the child meets the listing. And, again, the child guide, which is actually it's actually a little bit longer than the adult guide because I really wanted to go into a number of different child conditions, and the forms can be a little more extensive. But the child guide actually covers, all of I think I have every form covers ADHD because that's such a big one, and I've got other medical problems as well. So I think I did three conditions, physical, mental, and ADHD for each one. So every form is filled out three times. So you've got a pretty good guide to filling out the forms correctly for the child cases.
Okay. Now, so when you say SSI, I'm just thinking back to the previous conversation, SSI being less than SSDI, and the reason why it's SSI is because they haven't worked. Is that right?
Right. SSI is essentially a welfare program.
Okay.
And essentially what it means is if you have very low income and you have very little in terms of assets, you would qualify for SSI. People who have, you know, making $50,000, $60,000 a year are not going to qualify for SSI. The only thing that a child could qualify from that kind of household is something called the Katie Beckett waiver, which allows a disabled child to be qualified for Medicaid medical benefits. That is state by state. And that is really beyond the scope of the book because the book is really focusing on the disability. But it's within the scope of the book in terms of proving disability. But in terms of payment, a child from a middle-class household or a wealthy household is not going to get any monetary benefits, but they might be eligible for Medicaid, which in many cases is really what the parents are most interested in anyway.
So are children awarded the same amount? Is it a flat fee for every child?
It's a flat number, right. It would be a flat. It's going to be that $500, $600 number.
Okay.
But it's going to be subject to offset. In other words, if the parents have a certain amount of income, that might be offset by $100, $200, something like that, so that the actual dollar figure the child gets may be $150, $200 a month when all is said and done, but they do get Medicaid, which provides for medical treatment, which is really, again, a lot of cases what the parents are most after anyway. But the amounts are going to be capped, so it's not going to be very much money. But it can be some, and again, $500 a month is more than nothing a month, and certainly if you're, you know, in a difficult financial situation, it can be helpful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is adjusted every year for inflation, so that number does go up every year.
So this is a separate guide that you have, right?
Correct. Correct.
And we'll make that available at on the bottom of this site as well. Somebody can go and learn
about
that. so we've talked about the disability guide, which is your claim to fame that you have there, and then the legal network that you have, and then the children's process. Now, I know you're time sensitive here, and we're just about out of time, but I want to speak about a few other things and some of the work that you've done in this area. But before I do, if somebody was to go in and pick up this book, which, you know, I'm not certain what the price is on it, but and we don't need to cover that in this conversation, but is there any type of guarantee that you offer with the child guide and the regular adult guide? Like, if they don't like it, can they send it back to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, they can send it right back. I mean, I basically offer money-back guarantee. I mean, I think I put a lot of time into it. I think it's pretty good. And if it's not what somebody needs, then send it back, you know, unused condition, and I'll give them their money back.
No harm, no foul. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, you've done a bunch of other work in this Social Security disability space. You've done state-by-state information where people can come in and learn about that. You run a blog that you personally lend your time. It's like an online legal counsel.
Right.
I find it interesting. You're a lawyer that says, here, you don't need me. You can get my guide. You can come to my site. You can ask me questions, and I'm going to answer them free. And in addition to that, you're even running a radio station. So I want to learn about some of these few things in closing, if you could hit some of the highlights.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, basically, I've got a couple of blogs where I answer questions. I've got the internet radio program. I'll tell you, you know, in some ways, it's sort of a selfish reason. The blogs actually help me become a better lawyer, because when you're answering questions all the time, it really does go a long way to help, you know, solidify my information about things. People ask me questions that, quite honestly, I would have never thought of. I mean, I get some really, really insightful questions on the blogs. And a blog, for those who don't know, is a weblog, or it's a sort of an interactive website. And it allows me to really stay current with what's going on. I also subscribe to, and I encourage people to do this, other blogs in the Social Security disability area. Some of them are somewhat technical and are written for lawyers. But again, it allows me to kind of keep my eye on what's going on in the area, because the law does change, the process does change, and it allows me to sort of stay current with it. And when I answer questions, a lot of times I have to look things up. I mean, I don't necessarily know off the top of my head. I'll look it up, mm-hmm. and now I know, and it really helps me increase my knowledge. The radio station, or internet radio station, is just a way for me to answer questions, because some people don't like to read, and I realize that, you know, reading long blog entries can be, you know, for some people it's difficult, especially if they can't see real well, if they don't have a good education. And so the radio station is a way to answer questions and to disseminate information in a verbal way, where I can basically answer the questions for them. Basically, the same type of questions I get. I solicit questions on all my websites. People can ask me the question. If it's something I think has got kind of a common appeal, I'll just add it to the radio program. I generate radio programs usually two or three times a month, and it's only maybe 10, 15 minutes at a pop. Mm-hmm. But it's a chance for me to interview folks. Just like you're interviewing me, I might interview another attorney who's done something kind of interesting, and I'll talk about case studies and how I won a case, or how a case got lost, or even interview clients and ask them what they thought. It's just a way to sort of add a little bit of dimension to the practice, so I can help people understand what this process is all about. Because it's really, you know, it's really a rewarding area of practice. I've done a lot of different kind of law in my career, and it's kind of neat when you can make a major difference in somebody's life. You go into a hearing, you win the hearing, and now they have some money to live with dignity, and they've got mm-hmm. access to medical treatment, and they've got some a lump sum coming in. They feel like that they have some their life back. And, you know, nothing better for me to see somebody, you know, get on disability, than they kind of get themselves together, and they're able to go back to work, and that's really very fulfilling.
Yep.
So this is sort of my way to give back a little bit.
Well, I can see that. I mean, there's the twofold thing, and I want to come back to this blog in a minute, but I see that, you know, from the financial incentive being minimal for a lawyer to get involved in the beginning, and so people need help to fill these, you know, to get this process going. So this whole guide thing is a clever idea. Now, I just want to make sure I'm, you know, I spend a fair amount of time online and know a little bit about blogs, but I don't know, maybe everybody else out there does, and it's just me that does know a whole lot. But from a blog perspective, I just want to understand how it works. If I come into your site and I want to ask you a question or learn something, are you saying that I can ask that question, submit it to you, and then you turn around and post it back, and then those responses that you have, that's what you're referring to as a blog?
Correct. Basically, okay. A blog is a specialized kind of website that, instead of just being something you write and just sits out there, it is designed to be updated on a daily or weekly basis.
Okay.
And so on the blogs themselves, or actually on any of the websites, there's a place where somebody can ask a question. And that question comes to me. It comes to me as an email. And if it looks like it's a good question, something that I think other people would be interested in, I'll basically cut and paste it, put it on the blog, and essentially my response to that individual's question becomes part of the public. You know, it's in the public now. It's part of the website.
Okay.
So these are questions that I get from folks all over the country. It may be a simple question about, you know, how much money, where can I find out how much money I'm going to get, which is, again, that 7,400 strategy. Just it's really just a way for me to answer questions that otherwise I might answer on a one-to-one basis, but I can do so, and everybody benefits from it. Of course, I take all the personal information from it, but it's a way just for me to sort of share the knowledge. Instead of sharing with one person, I can share it with a lot of people.
Okay, very good. Last thing before we run out of time here is you have state-by-state information that you're going to allow us to tap into. And as I was looking at it, if I understand it correctly, somebody can go in and they can indicate the state that they're in, the condition that they have, right?
Right.
And there's a sorting process that you have that will bring up resources that will be beneficial for them for Social Security disability. Is that correct?
Exactly. What I did was I took every state has a little bit different process in terms of the addresses and numbers for the state agencies and just the contact information for the appropriate people. And as appropriate, if there are some strategies that are more applicable in one state versus another, I'll put that in there as well. But I basically have where somebody can go to the site, they can click on their state. It's a drop-down menu. And if they live in Arkansas, they click on Arkansas,
mm-hmm.
and it comes up kind of a strategy for winning a case in Arkansas.
Okay.
Or a strategy for winning in Florida, wherever it may be.
Okay.
And then they can also do a select for their condition. So, for example, a lot of the common conditions that I get lots of questions on, fibromyalgia is a real big one, cardiac problems, depression. I took the five or six biggest ones, and basically I did a whole little section of the website about those conditions. So they can read about strategies of how to win a fibromyalgia case, how to win a heart disease case, an asthma case, a diabetes case. And I keep adding to that. So every time I come up with a strategy that I think has some general applicability on a medical problem, I'll add it to the website. But that's just a way for people to get some more customized information that will relate to their particular situation as opposed to Social Security as a whole, because a strategy for fibromyalgia is going to be different than a strategy for cardiac problems.
Okay. Awesome. Okay, let's recap, okay? I want to see if I get it all right, see if I pass the test.
All right.
Here's what I see and what I think I have this mapped out here. Is some of the key points that people want to take away from this is have a consistent regular medical treatments, right? One of the first things.
Correct.
Second to that is they want to make sure that those are well-documented, keep awesome records, run this, look at it like a business, and keep requesting your records on a 3 or 4 month basis. You want to guard those records so you have them at all times. Don't trust the fact that somebody else has them and they're going to keep them and they aren't going to get lost, right? Whether it's your doctor or Social Security. Okay, use the guide to speak to the adjudicator if you're just starting this process and you want to speak to the adjudicator in their language, using ideally if you can a listing. One of the 14 listings. If a listing doesn't apply, then you want to work in the right language that will allow you to win on a functional capacity. All right? Are we in line so far?
Well, so far, so good.
Okay.
No, the only thing I would say when you say the listings, either 14 are listing categories. Within each category, there's going to be 10, 12 listings themselves. So
okay.
It's not 14 listings. It's 14 categories of listings.
Okay.
But otherwise, that's correct.
Okay, and somewhere in there you want to get this form 7008 that's in the guide and send that in, find out how much money you're going to get paid.
That's correct.
Okay, the next major step that I see is you've gone through, you've applied, you've put your application through the adjudicator. If it didn't get picked up there, they're going to send you back a reconsideration in some areas, not all, right?
They're going to send you back a denial notice, and then you have to file for reconsideration.
File for reconsideration, thank you.
Correct.
And it's not common that you're going to be approved at that stage, so chances are you're going to be denied, right?
Correct.
So you have 60 days to request a hearing. At that point in time is when you need to come to the bottom of this recording here, back to this the Disability Guide website, and click on the form and go in and find a lawyer. You can use any lawyer you want, but you can use the lawyer here. And that's what I see as the major steps.
That's correct. You got it.
Okay. Okay. Great. I've learned a lot today. Listen, I want to thank you. This has been great. You do great work. You do a lot of complimentary work that's just super for people, and the results that people are getting with the guide are the testimonials that I've read and people I've talked to have been fantastic. So thank you for your work. Anything in closing that you'd want to share with us? Final tip or trick or bad joke or anything?
Yeah, no, I mean, I could tell you some lawyer jokes, but I don't want to go there. I would just say that with Social Security, the big thing to remember is that this is a government system. You've got to speak their language. It is a long, drawn-out process. You know, you got to be prepared, and you have to just, like, I think the way you put it earlier was you have to look at this as a business. You know, your job, if you are disabled for the next couple of years, is to, you know, prepare yourself to win disability. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing for people to sort of consider themselves as disabled. But you've got to realize that, you know, if you are disabled, you know, it's tough out there, and you've got to look for every source of income or medical treatment you can possibly get. And if you're eligible for this type of stuff, then go for it. You know, far too many people, I think, just wait around. They don't do anything until it's too late. They've lost their eligibility. They've lost their insurability, and they don't have anything. And then you're really, really in trouble. So I would just say what you said before is make this your business. Make this your task for the next couple of years. That's very, very sage, important advice.
Okay, great. Listen, in closing, thank you very much for taking the time. Powerful information. You do great work. Thanks for sharing everything.
Well, my